during possible work session? No, okay.
Let's not start. Please come to order. We're going to take up House Bill 2550 first. We were going to take up 2492 first, but the Senate courtesy moved in ahead of the House courtesy, unless you're out of a committee. If you stand by a minute. Okay, Senator Yee is here to testify. Her chief of police, who wanted to be here, was otherwise occupied, but we do want to have a public hearing on this bill today. So if you can tell us a little bit about it, Senator Yee.
Mr. Chairman and member of the committee, thank you for your courtesy of allowing me to testify on House Bill 2550 first. I apologize for our chief police from Sweet Home who requested this bill. He has to stay in Sweet Home and testify in favor of his budget, which is being reviewed today. He would like to express his that this bill is very much needed. This bill increases penalty for people who provide or sell liquor to people below 21 years of age. He says it's very much needed and there's a serious problem. He would like to see that the bill restore the penalty to Class C felony for the ones who provide liquor to youth below age 18. It was taken out in the House side, and he would like to see that restore if your committee would consider that, his request. He thinks it's a very serious problem for people who provide liquor to youths below 18. They don't know how to handle liquor, and they really get extremely drunk, sometimes pass out because of that.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Frye.
It seems to me that if you give liquor to someone under the age of 21, if you give liquor to someone who's 17, you're giving it to someone who's under 21.
Right, okay. But he feels that the ones below 18 really don't know handle liquor
at all. But if you give it to someone below 18, it seems to me, under the way the bill is worded, then it covers us. It covers everybody that's under 21, the way the bill came over to us.
Right.
That would cover everybody down to the age of zero, I guess. Mm-hmm.
Right now, this bill says it's a Class A misdemeanor for anyone who serves liquor below 21. And he would like to make it a more severe penalty to make it a Class D felony for ones who serve liquor below 18. He just would like the committee to consider that as a more serious penalty. Mm-hmm. For the ones.
The way the House passed it, they raised it to a $350 fine from a $200 for the first offense.
Yes, he liked that. And he also would agree to making a Class A misdemeanor. But he also likes to see the ones who serve liquor to age below 18 a more severe penalty of Class C felony.
This would say that the people up in Council Crest, in my district, who serve vodka and orange juice for the graduation parties that will be happening right about now will be committing a Class C felony?
If they're below 18.
And they know the kids that they're serving are there, since they've known them since they were little, watched them grow up, they knew they were under 18, be a Class C felony. I couldn't very well go along with that.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chairman, I've got another example, too. An 18-year-old who gives a bottle of beer to a 17-year-old, Class C felony.
Mm-hmm. because he feels that the ones below 18 really don't know how to handle liquor, and he saw many cases where they pass out, and I think he mentioned in his testimony to the House that somebody died because of his passing out and not receive any help.
Those things do happen a lot. People go away when they're freshmen in college, and some of them who haven't been allowed to drink when they were at home drink to excess when they get away. And I've seen people pass out. I've never seen anyone die, but it can be extremely serious, I know. But the question is, what do you do about that? And to make it a Class C felony, I just don't think that there'd be very much equal enforcement of that, because you do have parents who think it's okay to serve alcoholic beverages to their, not only their children, but their friends' children, which isn't something I subscribe to. I can remember, it's only 25 years ago or something, that I went to parties where adults were serving alcoholic beverages to high school kids. So I don't think a district attorney would prosecute it. So you'd have something on the books that would only be prosecuted occasionally, and then that way it wouldn't be evenly prosecuted. I think that's probably why the House took that out.
But on the other hand, I suppose his thinking is, if the penalty is more severe, people will think twice before they give it to the really young teenagers.
That's possible, but I'd want to hear from some district attorneys that they would sign. I just doubt that district attorneys would enforce this very much.
And I
there
think
is a, they do increase the fine. I don't know how Senators Brown and Fry feel about that, but the $200 to $350 for the first offense, doesn't that seems like a good idea?
Yes, he said he very much supports that.
Okay, well, are there any other questions from the committee? There's Representative Van Leeuwen. Are you wanting to talk on House Bill 2550? Are you wanting to talk on the bill that you and Senator Yee have introduced, House Bill 2550, the drinking youth bill?
That's
sure.
What we're doing now.
Senator Yee is just completing her introductory remarks. She's explained the bill to us and said that she'd like the language replaced that the House took out that made it a Class C felony.
This is what Police Chief Savage said to me when I called him. Reminded him about coming, and he said he couldn't come, but he would like to see the language restore on line 13 and 14 if possible. Otherwise, he supports the bill.
Okay, for the record, I'm Liz Van Leeuwen, State Representative from District 37, and I had not thought about being able to restore any of the language in the House Judiciary Committee took that language out and changed it. Tell me real quickly what putting 13 back in does differently, lines 13 and 14, than is in the bill as it passed the House.
It will be a more serious penalty if we restore that language for the ones who serve liquor to youths below 18 years old.
People gave somebody under 18 something to drink, it would be a Class C felony, 5 years in the penitentiary, up to $100,000 fine,
right.
Maximum penalty. As a practical matter, probably probation, but they'd have to, it was a first offense, but they'd have to go to the circuit court, probably be put on state probation. And I'm concerned that the district attorneys wouldn't, I don't mean to blame the district attorneys in any way, I just don't think they would bring charges under this statute. They'd say
and the House Judiciary Committee removed that because of the jail shortage.
Yeah.
I mean, they're being real particular about how much of a burden that they put on the jails. And so that was the original intent, and I don't mind asking for it, but looking at it in reality, I was willing to accept this makes it somewhat of a stiffer penalty. They cannot, it increases the fine and they cannot suspend the imposition of that fine. And as I understand it, mm-hmm. as the bill is written, then on the third offense, there is a jail sentence. Is that correct? I should be telling you.
Class A misdemeanor has up to a year's jail sentence.
I don't know what your pleasure is.
The minimum sentence would be, as I read this quickly, it would only be the 30 days.
That's what I thought it was.
It would only be for third and subsequent, as far as a minimum sentence. Is that the way you read it, Senator?
Third and subsequent.
Or counsel. There'd be no minimum jail in this until the third offense, right?
Correct.
Okay, thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's the 30 days.
The original intent of the bill was, of course, to make it a much stiffer penalty for people who gave alcohol to younger people, and we've had at least, was this said before I came in? We've had at least three instances in the Sweet Home area in the past year where one boy who was 7 and I forget the others were young teenagers were given amounts of alcohol, and had it not have been for an EMT or one of the police officers arriving on the scene, they would have died from the fast consumption of alcohol.
Senator Cohen.
Have either one of you voted for the revenue raising measures?
I don't think that's before us.
It is, under the extent the fact that the amendments call for mandatory minimums. And I'm concerned about the mandatory minimum part of it, in the sense that that's one of the things that really makes the
mandatory minimum, excuse me.
Yeah, I'm interested in whether...
Would be the 30-day jail sentence.
Yes.
Is that correct?
That
May I respond?
We still have a mandatory minimum.
Mr. Chairman, may I respond to the question that was asked? I have not voted for a number of the revenue measures so far, but I think that this bill, in the increased fines that would be collected, would probably take care of that too, from the first and second offenses, first, second, and third offenses.
I don't think you did the arithmetic. It would, but that's anyway. Thank you. We will look at this bill.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Appreciate your. Bring it to our attention early.
Mm-hmm. We appreciate Chairman and Committee's effort in tighter and stricter laws for the drunken drivers, and I hope this will be part of the package you are sending out to people in the state.
Thank you very much.
Representative Anderson is here on House Bill 2492. And you have someone with you, don't you?
Yes, I have the person who requested the bill, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Representative Andy Anderson, District 45. I have with me Dr. William Alexander, who requested the bill. Dr. Alexander from Eugene is one of the nation's leading forensic specialists. What this bill does is allows a cross-check of unidentified human remains with missing persons, more than likely missing persons under mysterious circumstances. The Federal Bureau of Investigation has speeded up their plans and are expected to go online almost daily with a national network of missing people, and we would be able to hook right into this complete network. The state of California has had this in place for a couple of years. I'm told that last year alone they were able to make about 50 matches of unidentified remains that probably would not have been identified without their cross-match system. Basically, the way the system works is that the superintendent of state police sets up the record-keeping system, and missing people and unidentified reports are kept there. The with those few basic remarks, and I might add, too, that the Oregon Medical Society Association, the Oregon State Police, the Oregon Dental Association, and all groups have signed off on this. It did pass the House without a dissenting vote, 44-0. With those remarks, I would like to introduce to you Dr. Alexander of Eugene.
I hate to ask you to repeat something, but
yes.
you mentioned the groups that were involved in supporting this, and my mind was wandering.
The Oregon Medical Association, the Oregon State Police, the Oregon Medical Examiner's Office, and
Dental Society,
Oregon Dental Association.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Dr. Alexander.
Thank you, Senator Myers. To expedite things, I'd answer any questions that anybody might have.
How does this work?
This is really upgrading our process. I've been identifying bodies for over 30 years, and when I have one that I identify, everything's great. But if I don't, things bog down. Now, this new system is really efficient and will facilitate things. We have some 1,500 now that we would immediately put on a computer, and I think our turnover is anticipated to be about 500 a month in this state alone. So,
Mr. Chair.
500 unidentified 500, bodies?
Right. Portland has
a month in Oregon?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Good Lord. I had no idea. Okay. Senator.
No, that is the start.
You say there are 500 people a month in Oregon that are bodies found and people are having trouble and can't identify them?
The state police anticipate that we'd have a turnover. We'd be adding and taking off around 500 a month.
Oh.
The captain is here. He may...
That would be reports coming in and out of the state from other areas,
right,
too. Okay. I understand.
Like Portland has about 200 missing persons reported a month. Most of them are juveniles. Some are runaways and a variety of reasons that they leave home. And of course, they don't go on right away. It takes about 30 days.
Why does this cost $36,000 in general funds for the biennium?
I don't know.
That I should ask state police that, shouldn't I? Senator Hendrickson.
Oh, I was just curious, just briefly, how then, from the missing, does the missing persons file have their dental records or other physical things that you're, I was wondering, since if it's a computer check, how you can, or do you program factors in, or how do you, how would it work briefly?
Yes, Senator Hendrickson, it has everything that we can find about the person. It has their medical history, it has their dental records, fingerprints. Of course, after a certain amount of time, we have no fingerprints.
Yeah.
So everything we can find about them goes into the record.
And so what you're trying to do now is link up with that file, that computer file?
Yes.
The local jurisdictions would, or the state police would?
Local and state and national, and this also includes Canada.
So what are you doing now in terms of where you have an unidentified corpse there? You don't plug into that system for information. It's just ad hoc in terms of whether you can identify them.
Well, yes, we can. I think with or without the bill, we can accomplish a certain amount of. Interplay between the other agencies, but this formalizes it and really hooks us up on the basis that we should be. Last week, the state of Washington passed an almost identical bill. California has one, and I think there are three or four other states. And we're getting on the ground floor of what I'm sure is going to be a universal thing pretty soon. Mm-hmm. And as far as money goes, I can't answer you there.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Hammond.
May I briefly ask, although it carries no relevance, I suppose, to the bill, since this is more of a tracking system, what happens to the 500 bodies in Oregon?
No, I think these are bodies. The reports are coming
reports.
In.
Reports. Oh, yeah. Good grief. I was... Mm-hmm. Great.
Senator,
they're not identified. They just get buried in a potter's field.
That's what I was wondering. If Oregon, however many there might be,
they
I
often,
just thought it was New York's potter's field.
They often end up there. We are legally in a position to use material for teaching. I'm an assistant professor at the Health Sciences University in pathology and in charge of our forensic department, and many of them end up in the crematorium.
Is there any compensation then? I recall going through school and selling my body for that purpose because I needed cash to make tuition payments.
Maybe so.
Yeah,
well,
but there's no compensation at all for
no. Now, the other body we're talking about is the cadaver.
No.
And the
body?
No.
For medical school purposes.
Yeah, the medical and dental schools together have like 50 cadavers that they're continually dissecting.
Yes, I'm aware of that. I recall.
So how
that
do they then
vividly.
Find out? Do you have to get tattooed or something and then pick it up?
No, I was just, but as a student, we were compensated.
Okay, thank you very much. Let's hear from the state police. Robert J.
No, but I know, I've heard people selling about it in science, but then how do they, how would they?
Brickier?
Hmm?
Bricky.
Yeah.
I have Mr. Lloyd Smith from the law enforcement data system with me, too. That,
Lloyd Smith?
Yes, sir.
Law enforcement data, sir.
Yes, sir.
Well, will they track you down?
Did you find out?
Yes, sir.
How many unidentified bodies do we have that show up in Oregon?
I am not sure of the total, sir, but probably about 10 a year that we show up with. I think Dr. Alexander was probably talking about missing people, which we do have approximately that many people a year entered into the law enforcement data system.
500 Oregonians a year?
Yes, sir.
Mostly young people?
I would assume. Mr. Smith may have the breakdown on the ages if you're interested in that.
Do you have any information? Oh, about the AIDS. Well, that's all. Do you know why this wasn't in the governor's budget?
Well, I think the bill came up after the governor's budget went in. And as far as the fiscal impact statement, at the time that was written, it was before the law enforcement data system entered into the situation. And they maintain a file on missing persons. And basically, we were looking at maintaining a file on those people in addition to the unidentified dead people. So the impact would be greatly reduced from that. At the present time, we don't know what the impact would be, and we would have to look at it when and if the bill is passed and we get into the system.
Well, so, if there's only 10 bodies, would it be 10 entries a year then?
Well, I don't think you can look at it as 10 entries a year. We're looking at maintaining a file, collecting data, putting it into the NCIC system, and there's a little more than just maintaining the 10 names.
Senator Cohen.
Could I ask a question of the, do you have a computer program set up to put in that kind of specific data right now so that you put in that, you know, the programs and everything you could get from the national? I assume that the programs are written somewhere else, they're online someplace else, and you don't have to start from scratch to do that. Could you explain a little more how it would work and what kind of an impact it would be?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Cohen, basically what's happening is NCIC is the National Crime Information Center, operated by the FBI, is setting up the system on a nationwide basis. They currently have a system of missing persons. All the states are connected in and participate in that system. But the only way you can identify a missing person is by name and date of birth and that kind of information. Currently, there's no provision for entering the dental information and some of the other information, broken bones and that medical kinds of information that's helpful in identifying people. So what the FBI is doing is expanding the missing persons section. They're going to provide a way for local agencies to enter that additional information onto the missing persons records, and they're going to implement the unidentified dead file. So what will happen when an agency enters a missing person with that additional information, it will be spun off and compared within a short period of time, probably 24 hours, with the unidentified dead information. If there's a match, then the agency that entered the missing person and the agency that has the unidentified dead body will be put into communication with each other. The same thing will happen in reverse. If that information is entered with a missing persons record, someone else, another state, later enters an unidentified dead body record, then those will be matched up and that same communication process will be put in place. So that's essentially the way it will work.
What you say the cost has been greatly reduced from the way the time that this fiscal analysis was done, because I'm wondering why we shouldn't send this bill to Ways and Means.
Well, I think, like I say, virtually there'd probably be little impact at the time. The
there's
impact
going to be state, some entry into some existing computer availability. You're not going to have to add any new computer availability.
I don't believe so. The only thing that we would have to do is maintain a file in general headquarters of the unidentified dead body, work with the medical investigators of each county or the state, and collect the data that is necessary to feed into the system. And then when a match is made, then we would disseminate the information back to the local authorities, whoever is investigating the death.
Well, do you think you could provide information to legislative fiscal that would get them to change this? Where's the date on this? 5/12/83. It's only a little under a month old. What's the date this passed the House?
It's based on the amended bill.
It is based on
yes.
The amended bill. Based 36,000 based on the amended bill. I don't know if we can send a bill to the floor with $36,000 in it.
It doesn't require, does it, Mr. Chairman?
Senator Gardner.
Does it really require an expenditure limitation increase?
No, I think the bill would require us to go back before the emergency board to get the expenditure anyway, if we got
it. Set up. Yeah, I think we can send it to the floor. It's got no subsequent referral, does it? Does it?
No.
No.
I think it's all right to do it.
Would be nice, I mean, if we could get that reduced, if that isn't accurate.
No, but we've determined now that it is based on the, it is based on the amended bill, though.
Yeah. Well, I think the answer to it is they cannot, in fact, spend the money until they get an expenditure limitation increase, which they would have to go to the e-board to get. So, this is the time of year when things get jammed up in Ways and Means.
Senator Cohen.
I guess I'm trying to get some direction. Although normally in other circumstances would have moved it out right now, my suggestion is that you touch base with people who are in charge of those budgets if they haven't passed, or if they have, maybe the budget's even already passed.
State's budget.
It has passed.
It has passed also. And see what they recommend. I don't want to start a big fight about it, but I think we can quietly, we can inquire and see what the preferred.
Well, if everybody's comfortable otherwise, I'd suggest we move it out, knowing it'll take 3 or 4 days to get it ready to put on the desk. And if we find, and with the understanding that we will make that checking between now and then, and if people run up any red flags, I think I'd like to touch bases with the co-chair of Ways and Means, too, before we bring it down on the floor.
Sounds like it, yeah.
But if everybody...
Formally, I guess.
Senator Thorne, too, okay. It'd be Thorne and Senator Thorne and Ripper. But I'd just soon not have it on the agenda again if we could avoid it, unless somebody raised a concern, then we could just have a quick motion to pull it back. Would that be satisfactory with the committee? That is, if you feel good about the bill otherwise, which I so looks fine to me.
I'd move it out of the
okay. Senator Frye moves House Bill 2492 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. I think this is really an important idea in a way that we make our society more civilized if we find out what these unidentified bodies with missing persons.
That was the testimony and has been the testimony in the committee, that there are some judges that don't think that they
Jerry
can
Cooper
under that.
I'm sorry.
That do not think that they can order that as a part of restitution.
No, authority. Judge Bonebrake asserts that they do now have the authority.
Right. This would be in lieu of doing a special statute just dealing with incest.
Yeah.
So there's some consistency in the criminal code on this issue.
I move the Judiciary Council Amendments 6283.
Discussion. Senator Gardner's motion.
I guess my only comment would be is it's like the mediation bill. I think the courts have the inherent power to do that too, but I guess
I think they have explicit authority.
Yeah.
It's more than inherent power.
Right.
It's in the statute now, but they're apparently not picking up on that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I look at this as this kind of thing, just
underlining.
Right.
Clarification. There are policy directed from the legislature. They should be doing it.
Exactly.
Further discussion? If not, is there objection to Senator Gardner's motion?
Yes.
Please call the roll.
Brown?
Aye.
Frye?
No.
Gardner?
Aye.
Hamby?
Aye.
Hendrickson?
Aye.
Wired?
Aye. Motion carried.
Vote explanation, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Frye.
I have a little difficulty understanding how lawyers can say a law does something and then turn around and say, well, even though it does something, we've got to add some more language to it to make sure that everybody understands that it does something. Either does it or doesn't do it. Now, if the judges say, if we had a case or something that said it didn't cover that, then I'd vote for this. Well, that's my explanation.
I guess I have a bias in favor of, in spite of the fact that it probably puts more words in the statutes, in favor of spelling things out in the statutes, as long as it isn't done in endless detail, so that somebody can point and say, Your Honor, it says right here.
Yeah.
It doesn't make it mandatory. Do you want to move the bill?
I move the bill before you pass.
Okay. Senator Gardner moves Senate Bill 285 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion. Please call the roll.
Brown?
Aye.
Frye?
Aye.
Gardner?
Aye.
Hamby?
Aye.
Hendrickson?
Aye.
Wired?
Aye. Motion carried. Senate Bill 483. There's a mock-up in our folders here. Council, do you want it?
Yeah. Senate Bill 483 is the bill that fills in a fairly, I don't know if large is appropriate, but big gap between sex offenses in the first degree and what may be an appropriate lesser included offense, which right now would be sex abuse 2. And this is the bill that Pete Sandrock had proposed to try and give them some more leverage on lesser included offenses on instructions as well as, I'm sure, plea negotiations. So that's what this bill directly deals with. There's a mock-up based on a slight problem in the sex offense statutes, which is that sexual penetration with a foreign object is not defined in the definition section. The criminal offense itself contains what would otherwise be the definition of that. And so the original bill just referred to sexual penetration with a foreign object, and I felt that that would there's also a built-in exception to sexual penetration with a foreign object that's referred to on line 10 in this mock-up, which is 163.412. And so this just changes the language to clarify what we're talking about when we're talking about those that particular offense. And this is the one where it would make it a sex abuse one, a Class C felony, for a person to subject another to sexual intercourse, deviant sexual intercourse, or sexual penetration with a foreign object if the victim does not consent. That's basically what that's about.
And then also, the other words are the definition of consent, right?
That is also...
That had been proposed by...
Now, that definition was mainly discussed in the context of Senate Bill 713 in its original form.
Well, I thought, though, that we, in our discussion on that, that we needed that for this bill in terms of... Because we're talking about...
Right. It's whether or not the committee would want to... There is... That's also in your file, should be that definition.
Well, I thought that's an important part of this bill. Was my understanding from Pete Sandler. Because otherwise we won't have a definition.
Yeah.
Okay, well, does not consent is not currently defined anyway, and it is an element of the offense in sex abuse, too. So it'd be whether or not the committee would want to clarify what that means for purposes of both sex abuse 1 and sex abuse 2.
Okay.
I didn't hear the last thing you said because I had a message whispered in my ear. What were you just
okay.
saying?
I was just saying, right now, we don't have a definition in this part of the code. And I believe that we don't even have one in other parts of the code where it does not consent, like unauthorized use of a vehicle is where that issue comes up also. And right now, in sex abuse in the second degree, which is 163.415, does have a does not consent element, which is not currently defined. So any definition that we adopted would apply to both sex abuse in the second degree as well as that new provision in Senate Bill 483.
Now, and then this language was proposed by Pete Sandrock, is that correct?
Right, that was the language that was discussed between Pete Sandrock and Don Letourneau from the Metropolitan Public Defender's Office, and that's the language that they discussed.
They agreed to that?
Yes.
Okay.
I believe the preference, I'm sure, of Mr. Sandrock would be to not have any definition in there, but if one had to be put in here, this is the one that is agreeable to both.
Okay, 163.411 makes a Class C felony. Now, we passed this last session, I recall this, Senator.
Class A.
Class A felony.
For what?
Now, for sexual penetration with
right.
a foreign object in the
first
degree.
Right.
Now, what is this we're creating here?
This is with if there's not consent.
This goes relates to the problem of when you have a case where there wasn't consent, but it doesn't meet the standards of first-degree rape or penetration with a foreign object because of the forcible compulsion, earnest resistance, that there's nothing then. They've got a person that has committed a sexual assault, and yet because they don't have the elements of first-degree rape, they have to prosecute them for a misdemeanor offense. So this is to allow them in those instances to be able to have a felony offense. Actually,
Bill?
I consider this as a practical matter probably more important than the other rape
yeah.
bill.
The bill we passed today, where we said that you don't have to be in serious bodily harm, that would that apply to the sexual penetration in the first degree as well as rape?
It should. I don't recall technically.
Did we make the cross-reference?
No. In rape and sodomy and all the sex offenses in the first degree, one of the most the key element there, other than some of the other age elements, is forcible compulsion. This bill has nothing to do with forcible compulsion. This is a non-consent standard. And
no, but that wasn't the question
bill,
he asked.
My question is the existing law that makes it a Class A felony to sexual penetration with a foreign object, does that have the earnest resistance?
Yes. Unless the victim is under 12.
So the change we made today, that you don't have to be afraid of serious bodily harm, but only bodily harm, will affect the sexual penetration of foreign objects as well as forcible rape. Right? Senator Gardner.
Does this, Senator Hendrickson, definition of does not consent appear all right to you, Senator Hendrickson?
Well, I think I'd... That was not in the original bill. I'm more interested in the original bill and the amendments that were provided to, if that's what's needed technically on the sexual penetration. We didn't have a lot of public testimony on that does not consent in terms of what that would mean.
That's a critical element of
this. Yeah, and...
yeah, that's...
So I guess I would rather... move the bill as it is. As long as there's a case law definition to that.
Who suggested that we needed the definition of consent? Where did that come
Council.
From?
That primarily came up in the context of 713, which for all the first degree sex crimes pulled out a forcible compulsion element and instead put in the does not consent combined with a number of other factors. And that's primarily where the does not consent issue came up, because that was a major rewrite of the first degree sex offenses.
Second page. But isn't that language presently in the law in the does not, just simple does not consent in certain of the sex offenses now?
Yeah, sex abuse in the second degree.
Yeah, right. That's where it is.
It's sexual contact.
So isn't that a term of art that's been construed in that context?
Correct.
I'd rather just let it.
Yeah. What's the difficulty with simply using that? Like we use it in that statute, use it in this one. I don't see the problem with doing that.
Well, I think they'd be up to. No, I don't see any problem in doing it.
Yeah, I think
it's
I
not.
Think I think
that
I would
track the methodology of the existing law, really.
Yeah, I'd rather keep the change simple and just not deal with a new change. But I would just like to. I would move the amendments proposed by counsel on the engrossed page, as she's explained them.
These are the ones on the page one, right?
Correct.
Yeah.
At line 10 adds, or except as provided, or
right.
163.412.
All her amendments?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But not the...
definition.
Right.
And Mr. Chairman, Senator Brown.
Does the requirement of knowledge that is in that definition have any basis in the current law? I'm not sure if you answered that question.
This would not be what a jury would be instructed on this issue right now, I do not think.
Because this, the knowledge on the part of the defendant really is rather unique as part of the definition that does not consent.
Right, and legislative counsel brought that to my attention also. This is an unusual kind of definition because it gets into a mental element, mens rea element, in a definition as opposed to in the crime itself. So it is rather unusual to do that.
This amendment that Senator Hendrickson just moved is just to pick up penetration with foreign objects.
Well, no, we had that in the original bill, but this apparently is some technical refinement.
Well, it's something that I brought up, and the committee can discuss it. The original bill just referred to sexual penetration with a foreign object.
What is a foreign object becomes a question.
The problem is that it's not in the definition
that
section.
Session.
Right, but it's contained in the body.
It's not
of
a person's,
the,
it can't be a part of their body.
This language right here is exactly the language from sexual penetration in the first and second degree.
Right.
So, but the reason you put that in instead of is just so that those exceptions.
Okay, let me go to this.
It does
again.
Allow it does allow body cavity searches by law enforcement, bona fide ones by corrections people. It does allow medical examination. Is that what you're?
The
trying
reason
to?
I did it is that deviant sexual intercourse. Sexual contact and sexual intercourse are all defined in the definition section. For whatever reason last session, sexual penetration with a foreign object was not defined. So those particular sex statutes are very different from sodomy and rape, and that there's not a phrase that's referred to that's defined elsewhere.
Oh, so you
want to
make sure that this plugs so it back into the original sexual penetration one.
What I want to make sure is that you don't just say something where there's absolutely no definition of it anywhere, and I think that that could be attackable as being unclear and not... Now, if people can disagree with me on that.
If it's not defined, it certainly ought to be defined.
Did Legislative Council think you should do that, too? Or?
Well, ideally, what we should do, the ideal thing to do, but this would require much more than what this bill does, is define penetration with a foreign object in the definition section. That would make the whole criminal code on sex offenses much cleaner.
Yeah,
and then you wouldn't have this problem.
Yeah, we don't have that kind of time with this bill at this point. I would just like to...
Well, my understanding then it will be defined here, but not elsewhere, right?
Right, and it is not now defined.
And so you will have...
Well, it's defined in the original bill we passed had a definition of what the crime was.
There's a definition, but there's no definition section.
Where is that?
163.
Okay, if you look at
411, it says a person commits the crime of sexual penetration with a foreign object in the first degree if the person penetrates the vagina, anus, or penis of another with any object not a part of the actor's body, and so forth. So that spells out what orifices are involved in sexual penetration. That's the same language that's used here. But counsel's point is that language that explains what sexual penetration is not in the definition section.
Yeah, I think this is fine.
Senator Hendrickson has moved that we adopt the amendment that's on the mock-up of the bill. Is there further discussion?
Well, I have a question.
Senator Frye.
I'm having some difficulty understanding. We've got, seems like all of this conduct that was done with forcible compulsion is criminal. And then we're trying to make something criminal that doesn't involve forcible compulsion, but involves an element called does not consent thereto. Is that the right thing?
Mm-hmm.
Give me a hypothetical situation on where this kind of a change in the law is necessary.
I think the argument is that if you can't make out the elements of forcible compulsion, but you still had a clear case that the person was having this forced upon them unwillingly, forcible compulsion, you've got to prove that they were afraid they would lose their life or be harmed, physically injured, if they resisted, if they refused. If the district attorney did not believe they could prove that beyond a reasonable doubt, but did feel very strongly that they had a case, they could charge them with this lower crime, or for that matter, I suppose, plea bargaining, if they had a weak case, rather than trying to go to proof beyond a reasonable doubt that the person believed they would be injured if they didn't submit.
Well, it's not creating a new crime. It's just enhancing the penalty. It's the same thing. The crime is no different than what it is now, except it's a misdemeanor now, and this enhances it to a Class C felony. So in other words, what they do now is it goes all the way from a Class A felony down to a Class A misdemeanor. And I guess it's just how serious you think that conduct is. I happen to think it is something that should be in the felony range, even though it may not. Yeah, it's a non-consensual. It's an assault, and it's a level. I mean, in terms of.
Well, what is the situation? Can you give me an example of a fact situation where this it is not taken care of under present law that would be taken care of in this manner?
Well, I'm trying to recall because I think the district attorney brought some instances up, but it's a situation in which intercourse has taken place, or a sodomy, or a sexual penetration with a foreign object, in which the district attorney feels that they can't show forcible compulsion with, in the sense that they couldn't prove that the person would have been very severely physically injured or suffered, but the person was intimidated, they were, it was against their will. They were intimidated, they were afraid. It could be a situation just because of the size of the person, that they're, they are intimidated. The situation is such that they don't
the
feel
size,
they can
now
do...
Wait a minute.
Okay, I'll give an example of a friend of mine that was raped. She happened to be a policewoman. She was out riding a bike.
You don't have to give an example, and I shouldn't tease you about it. You said just because of their size.
Yeah,
because of their size, and they think
the victim is much smaller than the perpetrator of the rape. Yeah.
But there has to be the size has to be used in a menacing way. It's not.
Well, in those situations, it usually is.
It can't be per se. Everybody over 6 foot.
No,
four.
I'm not.
I know what you mean. I shouldn't be facetious about a serious topic.
Yeah, I think that women are not as facetious about that topic.
Well, go ahead with yours. I'd like to hear this example. Good. You started to tell it.
Yeah, I interrupted you. You were talking. I interrupted you.
Okay, the example I was trying to give was although this one was able to be prosecuted as first-degree rape, so maybe it's not a good example. But it was a situation in which the person was riding a bicycle out in the country. The person did not beat them. Did not have a weapon, but he was a lot larger than she was physically, and she felt that would be pointless to resist because she could be. I guess she did convince the district attorney that she felt she was in danger of her life, that he could have killed her. In a different situation with a different victim, I mean, you know, it's your word that you thought you were going to be killed, even though they might not have had a weapon. She was just in a remote place where it was down a ravine. She would not be seen. He was bigger than she was. He did not threaten to kill her, did not have a weapon. She made a judgment call that she thought it would preserve her life better if she didn't fight with him. And so those kinds of situations.
So this makes a situation where somebody didn't actually take a gun or club and threatened to beat somebody to death, but they forced themselves upon.
Well, she thought he maybe was crazy.
It's something less than an actual violent rape enhances the penalty.
Well, I think they're all violent, but I mean it's a matter of.
I mean violent in the sense of threatening serious bodily harm. Counsel.
Well, I was just going to say to me the other thing would be as a jury instruction on a lesser included offense, from what I understood from Mr. Sandrock, it would provide more options than just going from an A felony to an A misdemeanor.
All right. Jim?
Senator Gardner.
This isn't exactly, the substance of this offense would not exactly overlap sexual abuse in the second degree.
It does not, because that is just sexual contact to what the victim
exactly.
Does not
this
consent.
Is a narrower category of sexual contact. That is only, that's
yeah, that's
contact.
Just like touching.
Right.
Sexual contact is
this
very
is
different.
This is actually where there's
right.
Intercourse.
So it's not simply elevating the penalty for sexual abuse.
Well, no.
In the
no, it's elevating the sexual abuse in the first degree. From a Class A misdemeanor to a Class C felony.
In those particular circumstances that would have to be, that would be caught under sex abuse 2, under these.
Well,
sex abuse 2 is different than sex abuse 1.
Sex abuse 1 is a Class C felony.
Right. And sex abuse one right now,
but we're adding this element to it. So yes, it's true. It's not just enhancing it. It's adding this non-consensual intercourse to it. You're right. I was spelling
wrong. So it's not making it a Class C felony. It's already a Class C.
Well, that this crime is, and it's adding
another category
of it.
To an existing crime.
Right.
Correct.
Forcible compulsion is now required unless they're under 12 years of age or less.
Correct.
This is where the will is overborne, but it's not under threat of death or grievous bodily.
Well, if we amend the forcible compulsion definition, which is part of this amendment here, to take out that word serious, as has been discussed here, and forcible compulsion is defined as an implied threat that places a person in fear of immediate or future physical injury, or okay, then, you know, if that's what forcible compulsion is, it seems to me that if it doesn't reach that level, it shouldn't be a felony. That's, you know, you take out the word serious and you water down forcible compulsion an awful lot here.
Or I'll destroy your car, or I'll burn your house down. Any number of combination of things that's overcome.
You don't have to take a stick or a gun or anything else. Implied threat, some physical injury, which I think fits those categories that we're talking about.
Well, that's the philosophical, I guess, issue.
I guess the question he's raising is, if we've taken out forcible compulsion, the apprehension that you'll be seriously...
We haven't taken out forcible compulsion. We've only changed the standard of what they're afraid of from from serious physical injury to serious
physical injury.
That's what I was just saying.
Yeah.
And you're probably saying better, but if we've taken out the requirement that it be serious apprehension of serious physical harm, made it just physical harm, then what is going to be the difference between that and does not consent?
Well, again, if you've got a kid, you're going to have to say, well, I was afraid I was going to be beaten up. Some people are in a situation where they're terrified. They are...
The thing I'm trying to say is, though, if you get beaten up, you're physically injured. And we're making it now, you have to be afraid you're going to be physically injured. Not seriously physically injured, but physically injured.
That's right.
Okay. So if we've gotten that fixed, then how will this make it easier to prove the not consent?
That's what I'm trying to say. It's in those instances where the victim cannot, did not consent to having intercourse. Maybe the person didn't have a weapon or say, I didn't threaten to beat the person up, but the person was afraid that they were going, but, it's again, and I think we should, it's what they're going to be able to prove in terms of those elements. And if they feel... The prosecutors are not going to bring these unless they feel they've got a good case, but it may be light on some of those elements. And in certain fact situations are instances where there wasn't a consent, but maybe the person was intimidated by the other person. The other person may not have said, I'm going to beat you up, or carried a weapon. But still, the person acceded to their wishes against their will, but you may not be able to prove that they were going to be beaten up or something.
It'd be primarily where there's no fear of physical injury.
I wouldn't say that there wasn't a fear, but where you...
Can't prove it.
There may not.
I mean, that's the real point of this whole thing, is it makes it easier to convict someone now of a felony, a new felony. We're going to make it easier to convict someone of that. And I'm not... And that's a serious policy decision when we start tinkering with the criminal law and say, well, we should... redefine the elements so we can make it easier to get people convicted. Now, that's perfectly proper to do in some cases, and as the criminal law evolves, that does happen. But I'm fishing for good reasons why we should make that substantial policy change in our law. I think it is substantial, too.
Well, because the policy reason is to protect people from being raped.
The fact that you convict a person of a crime a lot easier does not really have too much relationship to whether you're doing anything about the criminal problem.
Well, I remember a situation where here that had a lot of impact on us here, because it happened to people in the building, where a person went to another person's place and they were going to go out to eat, and then this person decided they didn't want to wait till after they'd eat.
Wasn't that a PGE lobbyist?
I think I made a remonstrance on it. He was no longer a PGE lobbyist.
Only after, anyway. But that was sort of a situation like this, because I don't think that person...
No, they actually did. He gave her a black eye.
Oh, he did.
He struck her, yeah. But...
Okay, it's not a good example. But I guess there must be... Some people must think about pushing people when they want sex. Maybe... We got the word out that if a person isn't saying, yes, I agree, it's a crime. I don't think a lot of people know that.
But Mr. Chairman.
Of course, some people think that that's part of sex, too, I guess. Senator Brown.
The forcible compulsion, as we all know, is threat of death or serious bodily harm, either the prospective victim or someone else, but you can have a threatened arson, you can have a threatened destruction of a person's car or valuables. And so I think that if what has happened is that the will to resist has been overborne, that the will not to consent has been taken away.
Just
I think
explain the facts.
Go with, I, as a policy matter, I don't have any trouble with this.
I think you can conform yourself to this one.
Well, I think I can. I won't have any trouble.
Please call the roll on Senator Hendrickson's motion to adopt the amendment.
Brown?
Aye.
Rye?
No.
Gardner?
Aye.
Hamby?
Aye.
Hendrickson?
Aye.
Wires?
Aye. Motion carried. Somebody want to move the bill?
I'll move the bill.
Senator Brown moves Senate Bill 483 as amended. The floor will be passed recommendation. Discussion. I think this bill is going to have a lot more significance to district attorneys in dealing with negotiating with defendants than it is in.
I was going to say too, you know, this discussion about whether they consented. This is the same kind of language that's used on sexual abuse, mm-hmm. whether they consented or not. Mm-hmm. And so you don't have to prove so that people can't come up and touch you at will. You don't have to prove. I mean, it's considered that you have a right to be free from that kind of interference with your, you know, home bodily integrity without having to show you they were going to beat you up or that you were afraid they're going to beat you up. It's enough that you didn't consent to that kind of contact. And so I guess that's the same kind of theory that this operates on.
Trust everybody to vote yes on the present bill tomorrow. Get lots of space, you mean?
Get what?
Get lots of space.
Yeah, we need lots of space. Carve up these felonies.
Well, there's a Class C felony. It's not necessarily someone's going to be sent to the penitentiary. They're more likely to spend more time in the county jail if it's a misdemeanor, at least in Lane County. That's what the judges are doing.
Well, if an implied threat of some bodily injury is enough to make it felonious, and it should be, then I suggest that if you can't at least reach that level of proof, then it should be a misdemeanor. And we do have a misdemeanor on the list.
Well, I used to think like that, but
death is serious.
There are just so many instances of people pushing people into sex, and I didn't used to know that sort of thing went on that much. Senator Gardner is saying maybe we ought to have signed forms, but
maybe use it on the form.
Informed
consent.
Please call the roll on Senator Brown's motion.
Senator Brown?
Aye.